Buenos dias, world, from the San Diego Zoo Wildlife Alliance. I'm Marco Wendt.
And I'm Rick Schwartz. And we're your hosts for Season 3 of Amazing Wildlife, a show from iHeartRadio Ruby Studio and the global conservation organization behind the San Diego Zoo and the San Diego Zoo Safari Park.
Listen as we dive into the efforts here in San Diego and spotlight the heroes working worldwide to care for the species you know and love.
Listen to Amazing Wildlife on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Business Insight. My name is Bruce Starr, and I'm your host. And I've been a TV and radio talk show host and producer since 1993. And on this show, I have the honor of interviewing well-known athletes, celebrities, speakers, authors, and today, for the first time, an internationally known and accomplished artist. My special guest today is Cheryl Luxenburg, a Canadian artist, a water-based painter who paints in watercolor on paper or acrylic paint on linen canvas. She has been painting her whole life, but took her formal university education through to graduate school in clinical psychology. Cheryl was a clinical psychotherapist for 20 years, specializing in trauma with children and families. And when she became debilitated by a serious and chronic illness, she had to leave that career. Cheryl is someone who has truly reinvented herself, and her journey is one that is inspirational. So welcome to the show, Cheryl.
Well, thank you so much for having me here today, Bruce. Thank you.
My pleasure. So, Cher, what is it like to be a fully functioning, very achievement-oriented person, a professional with an intense career, and then over a short period of time, you get so sick, you're not able to function, the diagnosis is one in which there's no cure, only management, and on top of that, you have to leave your career permanently.
Well, Bruce, my life in the last couple of decades has certainly been an adventure, one that I never thought was ever going to happen to me. I went to, you know, elementary school, high school, university. I went to graduate school in Montreal and in Ottawa at McGill University and the University of Ottawa in clinical psychology. And I thought I was going to be a psychotherapist. I graduated. Helping people was always my calling, and it came natural to me. And I thought it was really a great fit. I worked within a psychologist firm for a few years, and then I started my own practice, specializing in certain areas of clinical psych, and it was really good. And everything was rolling around, like, perfectly. And then one day, quite acute onset, I got extremely, extremely ill, to really life-threatening proportions. And I realized that the diagnosis that I was given, although it didn't mean a death sentence, it meant quite a chronic disability, and that it meant that I wasn't going to be able to return to work as I used to see it. I wasn't even able to leave the house half the time. So I was kind of devastated. And actually, to be more accurate, I felt, Bruce, like really lost, because for all my life before that, I kind of thought I knew what was going to happen to me. And then all of a sudden, it's like the carpet gets taken out from underneath you, and I got really very disoriented and lost, and I knew that I was going to have to reinvent my life. And when, you know, if that's never happened to a person before, it's kind of like you don't have any kind of a priori experience, so it's kind of like you're doing it from scratch. So, I mean, at that point, I didn't know how I was going to spend my time, what my focus was going to be, and that is even like the times that I felt well enough to leave the house. I mean, I'm someone who's like very organized, and I like structure and schedules, and I like the idea of getting up every day and going to work and doing a full day's work and then coming home, and it had all evaporated. And I'd wake up in the morning and I'd say, oh my God, like, who am I? What am I going to do with myself? And then a little slowly, little bit by bit, my health stabilized somewhat over the next couple of years, and I realized I really still couldn't leave the house. So what was I going to do? So I needed to find something a few hours a day to do. And then I thought, aha, well, from childhood, I always liked to draw and paint. I've done this as a hobby since I'm a very, very young child. And so I thought, okay, well, I'll just keep painting and we'll see what happens. And I guess it's really saved my life. I guess that's kind of the point of my message here with you, is that my art has really saved my life.
That's really very inspirational, Cher. So how did you first begin your interest in art? I mean, some people play with baseball cards, or they want to be firemen, or they want to be nurses. How did you begin your interest in art?
Yeah, I grew up in Montreal, Quebec, Canada. I'm Canadian. My mother absolutely adored her parents. And my mother's father, I mean, he had a profession by day. And on weekends and in the evenings, his hobby was painting. And we would go over there every Sunday, and he had a basement studio. And, you know, after my grandmother fed me or whatever, and, you know, we were kind of talking and hanging out, I'd say, may I please go see my grandfather in the basement and watch him paint? And so I was allowed to do so. And so I would sit on a stool right beside him, and I would watch him paint and draw. And his style is, like, so different than mine. He was a cubist painter. I mean, he would be 110 years old today. So, I mean, cubism was a sign of the times at that time. Cubism was developed around 1908, 1910, 1912. And this movement wasn't long-lived, and it wasn't widespread, but it certainly began an immense creative explosion which resonated throughout all 20th century art. And this specific genre I found was really interesting, and it wasn't one that I knew would suit my personality. And I never, like, as a child, as growing up, as a teenager, I didn't paint in a cubist style. But I guess the early lessons that I learned was within this style. And so I would go every day. I mean, I adored this man, and I would sit on a stool beside him. I'd watch him. He taught me how to draw. And he taught me how to draw upside down, that if you want to capture something, take a photograph of it, turn it upside down, and kind of verbatim try to transfer the image. And he really taught me the elements of good drawing, which I believe is an element in representational art. And then he taught me how to mix colors, which I thought was even more fun. I guess in those days they didn't, like, now we buy paint in tubes, and it's very easy for us. But then he would mix his own pigment from scratch. And he taught me how to mix this pigment, just like the old masters did it, like the old school way of doing things. And learning to mix pigment from scratch gave me an invaluable depth of understanding of mixing color. And even though when I was a child, the Montreal Museum of Art ran a school. I went there my whole childhood. Went to the Banff Center for the Arts, which is the primo fine arts school in Canada. And even though I went to these schools, I found that they were teaching me the modern way, but my grandfather taught me kind of the old school way, and that was really interesting. Anyway, just a little note, Bruce, about cubism. Cubism, for those of you people out there who don't really understand what it is, it's basically taking the essence of an object and it's capturing it by showing multiple points of view simultaneously. It's my grandfather was like super talented and really quite geometric or mathematically oriented. And so it's very linear. It almost looks like an architect's drafting when they're drafting a home or a residence or whatever. It's like it's very linear and geometric. And cubism was a great fit for him. I mean, he was just such a Picasso wannabe. And I mean, still in my home, I have many paintings of his, and they're just absolutely wonderful, you know? When I graduated high school, I went to my parents and I said, okay, so what should I do and what should I study in university? I mean, I certainly knew I was going to go to university. And they said to me, oh, please, Cher, really, you need to pay the bills. And I guess, you know, they loved me and they were worried and they thought, you know, I'm just, you know, like fine art just may be too tenuous, you know, an idea. Like, it just might not work. You know, starving artists is like, you know, the favorite slogan, right? So they suggested clinical psych. They thought it was a good fit. I was always the resident, you know, psychotherapist on the block with my kit, with my friends, you know, from 4 years old. So that's what I did. And it's just really interesting, Bruce, how it landed up, you know, what landed up happening for me is like I did that for the first half of my life, and now I guess I'm spending the second half of my life, you know, doing art.
Well, you know, listening to your parents, you're joining the masses, the crowds of people that did that. And so many times we were, you know, they sent us off in a direction that truly wasn't ours. And it takes us to get into our 40s and 50s for us to really go at it for what we really, really want to do. And that's exactly what you did. And I know your art. I've seen it. It's really incredible. But it has a very specialized style. I don't know what that is. Can you tell us what that's called, if it is called a name?
Yes, it actually is really very specialized. And it's interesting because I'm Canadian and it's like so not Canadian. It's very American. I've been extremely influenced by the U.S. movement in certain kinds of realism. And Tom Blackwell, I'll just begin by saying, was a mentor of mine at King State College in New Hampshire. I did several summer residencies. And he was what is called a photorealist or hyperrealist. And he had a huge impact on me. And basically, my genre, my style, is photorealism or hyperrealism. Actually, I'm a hyperrealist, and I'll explain. Hyperrealism or photorealism is basically when the artist uses photographs as their primary source material to paint from. They don't use real life on plein air, in real life. They use photographs. And the difference between photorealism and hyperrealism is that photorealism pretty well copies the subject matter verbatim. Like, it makes up nothing different. It's exactly as the photograph looks. And although people think that that's what I do, I don't really do that because I always change something. So hyperrealism makes up the reality. It's fictitious. It's like made to look, although it's fictitious, it's made to look like it's always belonged there. For example, it's like painting the Eiffel Tower in Antarctica. Okay? We know the Eiffel Tower is in Paris, but I'm painting it in Antarctica. Or, you know, I love, you know, palm trees. There are no palm trees in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada, where I live here, you know, especially in the winter or in any time of year, you know, and there's when I crave the palm trees. So it's like painting, you know, palm trees in the Canadian winter. It's photorealism or hyperrealism is a genre which it accentuates the immediacy of the moment. It's very casual. It's almost like you've caught the subjects off guard, like you've tripped over them and caught them in their act. It's not staged. It's not fabricated. It's made to look like it's just always been there. I think I like the genre because it accepts life as it really is. And I am so much of a realist. I have trouble with fantasy and trying to do things that I believe, you know, will never happen. You know, I really try to stick to my intuition and accomplish what I think is real for me. I try to do, you know, control what you can and, you know, don't sweat the small stuff. So realism is, this type of realism has always been kind of really important to me. And then people always ask me, well, what's the difference between high realism or regular realism and hyperrealism? And the difference is that in realism, the subject matter looks 3D. It has a three-dimensional look, whereas photo or hyperrealism has a flattened depiction of space. And by flat, I mean it looks like it's similar to a camera lens. So basically, this genre was developed after Daguerre invented the camera and after technology got more sophisticated, I guess, in being able to capture high-resolution photographs. Overall, the movement was coined by an absolute, I got to give him a call out, to two brilliant men, Louis Meisel and Frank Bernarducci, who are in New York City. Actually, Louis Meisel, in the late 1960s, he obviously was very attracted to this brand new genre. He went and he gathered together a bunch of friends and different artists who painted as tight as this style requires, and he coined the term photorealism. He has published many books. He's a very, very prominent art dealer. And then a couple of decades later, or one decade, not exactly sure, can't be quoted on that information, he teamed together with Frank Bernarducci. And both of them have two wonderful art galleries in the United States. They are the cream of the crop in the United States that only specialize in photorealism and hyperrealism. One is in Midtown, New York City, and one is in Soho.
Wow. Very interesting. So let me take you back just a little bit. You were ill. You couldn't continue with your profession. And then you said to yourself, I want to paint. So what were the first images that you decided to paint that would get you from where you were to possibly where you wanted to go?
Okay. Well, I mean, as a very young child growing up, I would paint anything in front of me. I would draw anything in front of me. I'd be watching TV and I'd be painting. I'd be drawing the TV. I'd be drawing my hands. At first, my drawings were very illustrative, pen and ink, pencil, chalk drawings. And I would fill in. I noticed I was filling in, like coloring, like a very young child, colors with coloring pencils or crayons. And I would paint anything. It could be the flowers in the vase in the dining room, my backyard flower garden, architectural features of a building. I've drawn and painted my daughter many times. She doesn't like the way I portray her, but that doesn't matter. I would just paint anything or draw anything that was right in front of me. I always, in the beginning, I painted from real life. I would go into the garden. I would go right in front of the model. I would paint or draw en plein air in real life. And the paintings and the drawings, they would take one day. They were very quick. They were almost like a sketch. But they were very, I noticed they had a detailed, and my teachers used to say, they had an illustrated feel to them, almost like antique botanical books or antique medical books, you know, before the camera. How artists used to make renditions of old maps or old, you know, anatomical displays, etc. And then as time passed, I noticed I was drawing the people and the subjects much, much more in with more detail. And then I began to use the camera to capture details. I remember when I graduated from my undergraduate honors degree in Montreal, my parents gave me a nice camera. I forget, you know, one that you change the lenses, single reflex camera. And it was wonderful. And I had a macro functions on these lenses. And so all of a sudden I was able to, like, look at a subject and I could take apart the intricacies of a very small area with a huge amount of detail. And I think this changed things for me, because all of a sudden I was able to get so much more information from each, like, individual area. And so it meant a whole new way of working. And then as analog, that was an analog camera. And then as digital cameras and technology became so much more sophisticated, it enabled so much greater resolution. I mean, unbelievable what technology can, you know, gives us today. That this information kind of finally provided for me the information that was necessary for my, actually, I'm kind of, you know, embarrassed to say, quite obsessive, you know, painstaking details.
Well, you know, Cher, I also had a camera like that had a macro lens, and I absolutely loved it. And I, you know, from a different point of view, but I really enjoyed taking pictures with a macro lens for some of the same reasons that you did. So now I have another question to ask you. Could you share with us the development of your subject matter through the years? I mean, I note from your website and publications that you used to paint like streets of places, but your subject matter has changed more towards portrait. So why the change?
Well, let's go back 18 years or, you know, when I had left the clinical psychology profession. So there I am, and I'm pretty lost. And I like to travel, and I like to walk around the streets of places, be it my home or nearby towns or wherever in the world. I found myself walking around the streets of places, and the first, I guess, images that I became really drawn to was architectural features, particularly in the historic areas of cities. So I like to capture the architecture in of the like architecture that shows that it's aged, it's well-worn, it's shabby, it's deteriorated, it's decompensating, basically. And somehow I thought the subject matter was charming. I mean, if it was, you know, my friends used to say to me, well, why don't you, like, paint that beautiful shiny car? It's brand new. And I go, no. Like, I'm not attracted to something that works well or that's intact. I kind of liked things that weren't working so well, things that had shown the hands of time, something that has gone through a progress through stages. And I realized that what I was doing was I was identifying with the aging, the disability, a lot of handling and use of these objects, and that, you know, I guess I was talking, maybe I was trying to come to terms with what was happening with myself, that I was no longer perfectly healthy. I was no longer able to function in the outside world as I did. I no longer had the energy. I no longer had the health to participate, and that there was something wrong. And I think that I was identifying with the problems or the aging subject matter, deteriorating illness subject matter of what I was looking at with what was going on inside myself. I mean, I guess I was identifying with the not-so-pretty aspects of myself. I guess I was coming to terms, obviously, with the fact that I had an illness. I had a mark against my, you know, previous self. And I guess, you know, hate to be melodramatic, but, you know, that really I wasn't going to return to normalcy, kind of, if that makes sense, Bruce. As the years continued.
Sure.
As the years continued, I began then, so first it was architectural places. It was, you know, beautiful, worn, old, you know, 1600, 1700, 1800-year-old buildings. And then as the years progressed, I started to look at the people on the streets. And, I mean, who's the first people on the streets that you see are the homeless people. And then I would go up to these people and I would say, okay, you're panhandling and you'd like to make some money. May I please employ you gainfully, and I will pay you to be my model. And so I would paint these homeless people, and again, I was identifying with them that they had slipped through the cracks. They obviously did not set out on that journey in life when they were young, and look what happened to them. I mean, I'm not saying certainly that I'm going into decay or into, you know, I don't know, death or anything. No, I don't mean that. I just mean that there's a departure from what they thought that they were going to be to what they had become, slipping through the cracks, kind of, you know, being alienated from society, not, you know, being very strongly connected. So, I mean, obviously I knew that I was really personalizing with the subject matter. And I think I was identifying with them because, in a sense, I had lost my career also. I had lost my office, my former life. I had lost, most importantly, I think, a way to engage with the world and contribute to the world, because don't forget, you know, every 50 minutes before, the decades before, someone would walk into my office, I would help them, they would leave. And it was tangible, the results. It was immediate. And they would feel better, and I would be happy that I helped them. And, you know, when you paint alone every day, it's very isolating, and you're not sure how you're really directly contributing to the world. What I liked about the homeless people is their raw resourcefulness. I mean, I can't believe how some of these people survive. And actually, I really thought, you know, instead of looking at it in a negative way or whatever, I have, like, only compassion. I find these people are inspirational, and they've helped me to understand survivorship. Like, make do with what you have. You don't have to be so perfect. Celebrate the glass half full. You know, rebuild around disability. Rebuild around something that isn't exactly the way you want it. Try to rebuild around things that you can't change. Accept things that you can't change. So these people were wonderful, and I really helped to raise a lot of money for homelessness from these people, and you know, I felt I had done them a service. You know, I was gainfully employing them, and then, of course, giving back to their community.
What a great message, Cher. So what you're saying is that originally the subject matter captured the more objective kind of external environment, streets of cities, but that you've ventured into the portrait realm, the more subjective. Can you speak further about the subjectivity in portraiture? And do you think you've gone deeper into yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess that's what this interview is about. I think that that's my message. People often ask me, they ask me all kinds of things. Why do you paint what you do? And, you know, what's your work all about? And sometimes it's so serious. And sometimes what you paint isn't pretty. You know, sometimes it's hard, cold reality. And it's shocking. And it's not a pretty picture. It's not something that I'd, you know, kind of like to put up in my living room, you know. But I realized that the more portraits I painted, the more I realized that I was projecting my own feelings onto the models. It was my way of expressing how I was feeling, although I may not have been verbalizing how I was feeling, that I was having a hard time connecting with the world, that this was a change, you know, I had to reinvent my life, and that my life had taken a turn down really a different tangent. But for sure, the portraits that I was painting, the more serious and the more into them I got, kind of I meshed with them, and I realized that I had found a vehicle to express my feelings and my emotions. It's like the models were expressing my feelings for me, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yes, excellent. So we're kind of coming down towards the end of the show. Is there any other imagery that you've identified with to paint?
Yes. And I know it's kind of I almost kind of feel silly when I tell people this or when they look at my work. Believe it or not, I like to paint glass surfaces and wet skin. I like to paint transparent surfaces. I know it's kind of random, right? But I like painting transparent surfaces. And I think that the more into that I've gotten in the last few years, I mean, I've gotten really deep into this, and I think this is kind of my way of the future, I feel like I'm really coming into my own as an artist. Like, I've really found my own voice. Like, in the beginning, when I'd walk around the streets, I was captivated, yes, of course, by the deterioration in the, you know, the historic buildings. But I was also captivated by the storefront windows. Windows and glass has always, like, kind of fascinated me. I like reflections in the glass. I got a kick out of the interplay between looking straight into the glass, into the store, like to the back of the store, and then at the same time, the reflections of what was captured across the street. So the fact that one moment you see one image in the glass, and then you shift your gauge just a tiny bit, or the light changes, and the image changes. And I was drawn to the interactive nature of this, the changeability or the elusiveness, basically the interplay, I guess, of what between these two reflections. That's right, the interplay between the two reflections of how they're always capturing your attention. You see, when you walk down a street, yes, it's interactive. Of course, if you look at a building that's in decay, it's pretty and you look at it. But when you look at contrasting glass reflections, it invites you to keep on shifting your gauge, so you're going to move your head in different directions, and you're going to play with it a little bit. So it's more, a little bit more interactive than an image that is static. And there's something, I don't know, about the concept of fleeting that's really important to me, because I think that something that's fleeting is really fragile, and therefore it's really special. And I've painted quite a few of these window reflection series. I painted the Glebe storefront window reflections, which is in my neighborhood in Ottawa. I painted a series called The Abandoned Windows of Rideau Ferry. And most recently, I've painted a whole series called The Window Reflections of the Ottawa Convention Center. The Ottawa Convention Center is Ottawa, which is like your Washington, a brand new building. It's an architectural wonder. It's our architectural showpiece in Ottawa. It's magnificent, just a magnificent architecture. And actually, I'm having a show, a solo exhibition at Wallach Gallery in Ottawa from May 8th to May 23rd in 2015, this coming spring. And I'm really happy about this. The people often say, Cher, you never paint Ottawa. Well, I painted Ottawa, you know. And the convention center work is really extraordinary because this building is extraordinary. Because in the day, When the light is bright, the glass is like a mirror. It's like an elongated tulip or oval shape, and it's like an egg. And it's a mirror, and it reflects everything in its path. And so the convention center is on one corner of the street, and then our Westin Hotel is right at the other corner, and they're basically literally a few feet away. And the two buildings, when they interact together, when the light shines on it, the window reflections overlap onto each other. And this particular series is so different than anything I've ever done because it truly has an abstract feel. And I mean, really, I don't paint abstract. But you know what? I realized that in a lot of ways, it's very much like my grandfather's cubism style. Because it's geometric, it's like kind of slivers of lines intersecting each other. And I actually, in thinking about being interviewed by you today, that's what I've realized, is that this window reflection work is very cubist in nature. And it's interesting. Perhaps cubism shall be part, you know, I may use it in my future work. So it's this reflection work is really interesting because it's a whole bunch of intersecting transparent planes of glass that are all reflecting all over each other, and it was interesting imagery to work with because basically I'm a glazer. I don't mix color as much as I glaze very, very thin sheaves of color on top of each other. That's kind of my style. So it really lent itself, to glazing. Anyway, that's about my window reflections. And then as I began painting just more and more portraits, I combined the window glass enclosures or window reflections with people. And I noticed I started to hire models, and I placed them behind glass. I'm crazy. I poured water down the glass. And I painted the cloudiness and condensation and water drops, and I'd have hoses running over my shower in my home. And I played with the opaqueness and the transparency of the condensation, and I even created surface tension in the form of water bubbles. And when the subject, the portrait, the person was hidden from view, it kind of created mystery and invited curiosity, and I played with the curiosity even more by creating specific areas on the glass, surface of the glass, where the body comes into contact with the wet glass. So I was starting, I think that this was the first time I was really starting to add a playful quality to my work, because my work had been kind of serious before, so this was a bit playful. And most recently, I noticed that I'm painting women in my shower with, you know, water pouring onto their body and dripping off of their body. But I've dropped the glass enclosure, and by dropping the glass enclosure, I think that I'm able to reveal the real intensity of the people's facial expressions more. And anyway, so that's kind of, you know, I notice that's a progression in my work. The subject's relationship to the glass, like often when I used to paint portraits behind glass, I found that the glass was kind of like a container for them, maybe almost a prison, maybe a shelter from the world, maybe a defense, a structure or something. And I think that the more comfortable I feel with myself, the more I'm dropping the glass, and the more I'm freer to just be able to reveal the people, like with no interference or nothing to hide behind, if kind of that makes sense. I've recently painted a series of a woman in a shower called In the Shower. It's on my website. And there's no glass there, and it's there's water pouring onto her. And it looks at how when we take a shower, often it's a place that it's kind of our sanctuary for us. It's a place that's our nightcap. It's a place for renewal, rejuvenation. It's a place we erase the day. We don't realize it, but we process a lot of the day, a lot of our stress, a lot of problems that we have in the shower. And so this is kind of, this enacts, you know, how the shower is a place for all these things to happen. I think, Bruce, overall, what I've learned is that in certain situations, of course, when someone's commissioned, when artists are commissioned to do someone's portrait, of course we all must, we're paid to, capture the essence of the model. Of course, I've been asked to paint portraits before, and I truly try. I don't think about myself. I'm there to capture the model, and I do that, of course, and I understand that the makings of a successful portrait is the dialogue between the artist and the model. But, you know, on my just private journey, just on my little subjective journey, what I've learned that I feel that it is the artist that projects onto the canvas what they themselves, what me, I myself am feeling, and not necessarily at all what the model intended. And in this way, in my own subjective way, on just my subjective journey, I feel that every portrait I paint is kind of like a self-portrait of the artist. It's the model is purely the model, the incident, the accident, the occasion upon which I use to express myself. So it is not he or she who's revealed by the painter. It's rather the painter who on the canvas reveals himself and herself. And I mean, those two views are really interesting, and it's something that I would like to, you know, discuss with other artists as well, because I mean, I belong to several groups of and societies and associations of people who are, you know, the best portrait artists in the country, in North America, in the world. And, you know, I'm wondering how they would feel about that, you know? So in conclusion, I've learned that, you know, my challenge is really not so much to capture the essence of the model. I mean, I think I can do that because I think I paint really realistically. But actually, that's really not a challenge for me. It's more the ability to capture the essence of myself. I mean, my reference points have been, I've had a really difficult health history. It's been, you know, quite a journey. And it's through my art that I understand more about where I've been and what I struggle with. I mean, truly, whatever I paint is surely my voice. That's for sure, my own voice.
Well, Cher, it's been inspiring to hear you speak as both an artist and as a psychotherapist. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to be with us for this interview. And to reinvent yourself is a rough road, and I know that I've been on the same road. So the last thing, give us your website if you would like, and tell us how anyone listening to the show can contact you.
Well, all you do is Google my name. That's the easiest. And it's Cheryl Luxenburg, and it is spelled S-H-E-R-Y-L. And my last name is Luxenburg, L-U-X-E-N-B-U-R-G. If you Google my name, you will see my website. You'll see videos that I've made of my work. You'll see articles that I've written in American Artist Magazine, International Artist Magazine, all my reviews. Kind of everything's there. I have a website and videos and reviews, et cetera, et cetera. So just Google my name.
Thank you, Cher. What a great show. Learned so much. Learned a lot more about you. And I wish you all the luck on your journey.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Bruce, for interviewing me. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Business Insight. My name is Bruce Starr. We were just talking with guest artist Cheryl Luxenburg. Join us again next time. Bye-bye, everybody. Thank you for listening to The Love Coach Show, hosted by me, Bruce Starr. If you would like to contact me or the guest on this show, write me at lovecoach, L-U-V, coach, at AOL.com. Feel free to listen to the many other archived Love Coach shows here on Blog Talk Radio. Want to attend a Love Coach executive dating event and meet the love of your life? Contact me and ask how. And until next time, bye-bye.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.